Okay. All right. Well, from my end, it's good evening, but I know from your end, it's still good morning. So good morning, everybody. My name is Leah Herzog, and you are coming live from Givatsev, a small town between Yerushalayim and Modi'in. I was really thrilled when Emma shot me an email and asked me to participate. I lived in Chicago, actually, after I was married from 1986 to 1992, and worked and taught at Ida Crown Jewish Academy from 1989 to 1992, and they were incredibly, incredibly happy years, and loved living in Chicago, and love going back, and it was really amazing to see the faces of the people who are presenting at the conference. Dr. Esther Schupp is my mentor. I can really consider her my mentor to this day. And Lynn Kraft and I were colleagues at Mayanot way back in the day, and you know, some really great people. So I know I don't have a lot of time, and I'm notorious for over preparing and having too much material, so I want to jump right into it. So the topic of today's shiur is called the Midbar, and really what I want to talk about is how the Midbar, the desert, is a symbol, particularly in Sefer Yirmiyahu, which we're reading these days, but really throughout Tanakh, beginning back in Bereshit. And what we're going to look at today is how the Midbar is a paradoxical symbol, and kind of at the same time that it represents desolation and destruction and wilderness and, you know, total lack of any kind of civilization and amenities, on the other hand, it represents the most fertile, and I use that word intentionally, place for communion with the divine. I'm going to screen share here so that we can go right to the Google Doc, which is from Safaria. Hang on a second. And no, you are not hallucinating, by the way, if you're seeing dark background and white print, because I'm visually impaired. That's easier for me to navigate. And from what I've been told, it's actually easier for a lot of other people to navigate. And you can find this source sheet on Safaria, in which case you can click on hyperlinks and all that. But this is a Google Doc, and you can feel free to print it out and use it and all of that. So the Midbar, communication, communion, communication, and exile. And the first thing that I want to point out is all of these things that the Midbar represents. And I just, as I'm kind of going through a little bit of an introduction, I want you to think about an experience that you may have had in a wilderness, whether it was an Israel wilderness, whether it was a desert southwest wilderness, whether it was the Black Hills of North Dakota. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of wildernesses. A Midbar, as it's discussed in Tanakh, is not the sandy Saharan wilderness that we typically think of when we think of a desert, but more like just a dry, harsh scrub landscape, kind of like the desert southwest of the United States, but also with mountains. One of the things that surprised me the first time I ever went down into the Sinai, when one still could, back in the 1980s, was all these mountains. Now, I mean, Har Sinai and Har Horev and Hor HaHar should have given it away, right? But, you know, you kind of think of a desert as a place of being wild and sandy, but not necessarily mountainous and rocky. But certainly in this part of the world, it very much is. And typically throughout the Tanakh, the Midbar is used as a symbol of desolation, of destruction, of thirst, of hunger, of, you know, very, very, very harsh conditions. We just finished up Sefer B'Midbar, where B'nai Yisrael spent the better part of the Sefer complaining about the conditions of the desert, and rightfully so. I mean, it's a scary place to be. And if you're never 100% sure where your next day's nourishment is going to come from, or is there going to be a well, or is there going to be water, that's pretty terrifying. So it's, I always say that you know, B'nai Yisrael were in their right with what they were complaining about. It was more of a question of how they were complaining. So in Sefer Yirmiyahu, which is the Sefer that we spend time on right now, the first and the second Haftarot of the Shlosha de Puranuta, both the Haftarah that we read this past Shabbat and the Haftarah that we read the Shabbat before, and some of the other Haftarot that we encounter throughout the year that have to do with rebuke and tochacha and, you know, B'nai Yisrael, you're doing the wrong thing and the Beit HaMikdash is about to be destroyed. The Midbar is a very potent symbol in the Sefer. But what's fascinating, and this is what we're going to get into now, is that the Midbar is both a symbol of desolation and destruction, but is also the symbol of that place where B'nai Yisrael and Hashem come together. So what you have in front of you here is the end of the first Haftarah of the Shlosha de Puranuta. The first Haftarah begins in Yirmiyahu Perek Aleph and continues through Yirmiyahu Perek Bet Pasuk Gimel, verses 2-3, and then the second of the Shlosha de Puranuta, the one that we read this past Shabbat, begins with Yirmiyahu Perek Bet Pasuk Dalid and continues for a while. And Perek Bet is quite long and somewhat repetitive. And I purposely broke it up this way because I want you to see how in the course of several psukim that actually don't have, they have a break, but they do seem to be contextually continuous. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that in a second. You have two completely polar opposite images of the Midbar. Sefer Yirmiyahu is a weird kind of a sefer because we really don't know why it is organized the way it is. What we do know, and we know this from the author himself, is that Yirmiyahu spent a very long time sitting in the royal jail writing out all of his nevuot. They were then brought to the king, who summarily, one by one, and in a very public fashion, threw them into the fire and burned them. After that, Yirmiyahu's scribe, Baruch ben Neria, was instructed by Yirmiyahu, who didn't have the heart to do it himself anymore, to rewrite the entire Sefer. So Baruch basically sat down, took dictation from Yirmiyahu. Right after that, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. So there wasn't really the time to compile all of the Nevuot into one kind of a flowing narrative. So the reason the Sefer is disjointed is because it was written at a time and place where it could not be joined. Why Chazal, during the time of the Second Beit HaMikdash, organized the Sefer the way they did, which seems sometimes haphazard, is a big mystery. And Menachem Liptak has a whole series of shiurim dealing with that, which you can find on the, I think he has his own website, but also on the Haaretzion, on the Gush Etzion virtual Beit Midrash. Anyway, so Perek Bet begins as follows. Vayihi devar Hashem elai lemor. Haloch v'karata be'oznei Yerushalayim lemor. Ko amar Hashem, zacharti lach chesed ne'urayich, ahavat kelulotayich, lechtech acharai b'midbar, be'eretz lo zru'ah. What we have here in this pasuk is the language very, very intentionally of Shir HaShirim. This kind of language, which is a much softer and more flowing kind of sound, immediately takes the listener back to that love story that is Shir HaShirim. What's important for us to remember, any time we're learning Nevi'im Achronim in particular, right? Anything from Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Trei Asar, as opposed to Nevi'im Rishonim, is that these Nivuot are designed for the listener. They're not designed for the reader. So the word choices, the sound choices, the alliterations, the images, the metaphors are all critically important, because what he is trying to do is capture a mood and convey that mood to his audience. So when Yirmiyahu says the words, "Zacharti la chesed ne'urayich, ahavat klulotayich, lechtech acharei b'midbar be'eretz lo zu'ah," immediately the listener is going to start thinking about Shira Shira. Ahavat klulotayich, right? This is the famous midrash that the moment of Har Sinai, the moment of Matan Torah, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, is the wedding, basically, between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael. And what makes Yirmiyahu so tragic is that while Yirmiyahu is verbally kind of flipping back through that wedding album or watching the wedding video that existed between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael, he's also preparing to write the bill of divorce. Right? This is the time, the final moments, right before the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. So we think of Bnei Yisrael in the wilderness, right, as we saw them in the last parshiot of Sefer Bimidbar. But the way Yirmiyahu is describing it is that it's to our credit that we followed Hashem into the Midbar. In other words, yes, the Midbar is a place that is uncivilized and unfertile, and you know, there's no food and there's no water, but you, meaning Bnei Yisrael, were so in love with me that you were willing to follow me into this place. You know, I don't know what the weather's like in Chicago right now, but it's pretty darn hot here. And it's July, it's Israel, the temperature gets up to about 90, 91, and that's in the mountains of Jerusalem. You know, down in the Negev in the south, it gets up to 100, 105. You know, again, think of Las Vegas, think of Phoenix. And you know, there's no GPS, there's no cell service, there's no phones, there's no maps, right? It's you and the ground and the rocks and the stars and the snakes and the scorpions and the sun and the moon, and that's it. It's just you and the elements. And yet we not only willingly but happily went into this place of desolation. We didn't care. We didn't notice it, because we were so young and in love and adoring of Hashem, right? And we don't think about this when we read the narrative of Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bimidbar, right? Because we just hear the kvetching. But this is how Hashem is kind of remembering it. And not only were we young and in love and adoring and would follow God into this wilderness, but on the flip side, Kodesh Yisrael LaHashem Reshit Tvuato Kol Ochlav Ye'eshamu Ra'atavo Alehem Ne'um Hashem. Right, Bnei Yisrael. This is Hashem talking at that moment of engagement, the moment, you know, that whirlwind romance that we had for 7 weeks before Har Sinai. Right? Hashem adored us so much that he would literally kill anybody who touched us, right? Whether it was the Mitzrim at Kriyat Yam Suf, or whether it was Amalek, or, you know, any of our other enemies, even if we struggled with them a little bit, but at the end of the day, they fell. And this kind of protection and this kind of a love lasted for 40 years. That's a long time. And I heard a wonderful explanation about why we have all of the travels of the desert in Parashat Maaseh, which we just read, right? 42 stops. We went here, we camped. We left here, we went there. We went there, we camped. We left there, we went the other place, and on and on and on. And like, what is the point of that? Because it allows us to look back on those 40 years and see where we've been, what's happened, and how the real constant of those 40 years, or 38 and a half of those 40, is that we had a peaceful, loving, symbiotic relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu as we're wandering through this hot, dry, dusty, snake, scorpion, and large creepy crawly thing filled wilderness. You don't think of a wilderness like that. But then we see the other side of the wilderness in Yirmiyahu. So now he says, Shimu Devar Hashem Beit Yaakov V'chol Mishpachot Beit Yisrael. This is this past week's Haftarah. And the irony of these words, Shimu Beit Yaakov V'mishpachot Beit Yisrael, like it's dripping. You and I might not necessarily catch it, but I'm going to scroll forward for a moment, right, and look at, I think it's source number 4, if I'm not mistaken, right? Nope, it's not source number 4. That's source number 3, source number 4, source number 5, and source number 6. So it's source number 6, right? This is the lead up to Matan Torah. And what does Hashem say to Moshe, right, when he first goes up the mountain? Umoshe ole el ha'elokim vayikra elav Hashem min ha'har lemor. Ko tomar lebeit Yaakov v'taged lebnei Yisrael. Right, bnei Yisrael, beit Yisrael. But when we hear that, when Yirmiyahu says these words, right, his audience is going to, which has just now heard, I'm going to scroll back, I'm sorry if I'm making you dizzy. So his audience, right, has just heard this beautiful introduction, right, about Zacharti la chesed neurayach lechteich acharai bimidbar. And then we hear the lines that are so reminiscent of Matan Torah, but what's the next thing that comes out of his mouth? Now he starts rebuking them, and he's like, you know, why didn't you have an argument with me? Why didn't you come looking for me? Why did you not believe that I could supply you your needs? Undertone, why were you not afraid that I could punish you? Because velo amru ayeh Hashem, and you didn't say, where is Hashem? Hama'alcha otanu me'eretz Mitzrayim, hamolich otanu b'midbar, be'eretz areva v'shucha, be'eretz tziya v'tzalmavet, be'eretz lo avarba ish velo yashav adam sham. Right? Look at the translation, right? How the desert is described, how this wilderness, right? A desert and a place of deserts and pits and drought and darkness, and a place that no man has traversed and no human beings have dwelt. Right? And that's where we traversed and dwelt and had light and had man and had food and had shelter for 40 years. Right? So you have this incredible contrast in Yirmiyahu, and it's so painful, right? Because on the one hand, you have like the surface level, right? Of the midbar, which is this description. And then you have what the midbar really was, which was the cradle of our relationship. And Yirmiyahu goes on in this is a little bit later in Perek Bet. Again, it's a long Perek. And what are we compared to? Yirmiyahu uses a lot of animal metaphors. Yeshayahu, by contrast, uses a lot of botany and botanical metaphors. He does use some animal metaphors, but he's more a man of the field. He uses a lot of those, but and Yirmiyahu really talks more about animals. And he says, this is a little bit later, the same theme, right? You didn't look for me, and you didn't argue with me, and you didn't engage, right? We didn't go to couples therapy, as it were. But you also weren't afraid of me. You also didn't remember that the same God who sustained you in this wilderness is the same God who's going to be able to kill you and to drive you out of this land and for the temple to be destroyed. And he says, Eich tomri lo nitmeti, how? And he's talking, again, Bnei Israel here is always the woman. We are the metaphorical woman. We are the woman in Shir HaShirim. We are the woman in Yirmiyahu. Hopefully we'll still get to Hosea before the end. We are the woman in Hosea. And we're either the virtuous woman, right? The Doda, the Ra'aya, right? The loveress, the beautiful princess, or we are the not so virtuous woman, right? We are the Eshet Zanunim, we're the harlot, or we're the adulteress, right? But either, whatever it is, we are, B'nai Israel is the wife. But Tomri, how could you say, Lo nitmeti acharei ha-be'alim velo halachti re'it arkech, right? How can you lie about the fact that you do avodah zarah and you go after these other gods, right? And what are you? Ma'asit bichra kala. And again, I want to go to the English translation here, right? You are like a lustful sheik animal. This is a desert animal, right? Where you're restlessly running around, or you're like a wild donkey, a wild ass used in the for the desert, snuffling the wind in her eagerness, right? Whose passion none can restrain, right? None that seek her should, and I'm sorry, anyone, none that seek her need grow weary, right? In her season, meaning when she's in heat, they'll find her, right? So Yirmiyahu uses these animals, the donkey and the camel, but they're wild animals, and they're wild in the sense that both they're wild in that they can't be domesticated, but they're also wild in pursuing their passion, right? They're unrestrained. And we know that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed for three reasons. One is because people did Avodah Zarah, did idol worship and everything that culture represented, which basically was a culture where might made right and bigger was better and numbers mattered, which stands obviously in stark contrast to Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and a society that should be grounded on Chesed U'Mishpat, right? That's this coming week's Haftarah. So that was one. Another one was Shvichut Damim, that they just killed each other. And not only did they kill each other in the sense of murder, but they used the Sanhedrin to kill people, right? The Sanhedrin would frame people. And one of the reasons we have all of these rules about how making it so intensely difficult to put people to death was that when Ezra and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah came back in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, there were many, many safeguards instituted. But during the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, it was very, very easy to put somebody to death. And finally, the third issue was the issue of Gilui Arayot, of illegal, illicit, and inappropriate sexual relationships. And the basic, you know, if you read the Nevi'im Achronim, you read the Treyasar, one of the biggest problems was that people just followed their lusts. Men, women, didn't matter. They just followed their lusts. The concept of sexual propriety, of modesty, of monogamy kind of went out the window. And this was a huge problem because, again, people weren't scared of repercussions. They weren't scared of the repercussions of the people that they were betraying, and they weren't scared of the repercussions from God. So Yirmiyahu says, you people of the wilderness, you people that I married in the wilderness, you are wilderness animals, but it's not a compliment because you are wild and unrestrained. So I want to move now into where we find the wilderness, so to speak, for the first time in Tanakh. So our first introduction to the Midbar, kind of not only as a place, but as a concept, as a culture, as a backdrop, really, is with the story of Yishmael. Right? With Avraham, he comes from Ur Kasdim, he gets to Canaan, he goes down to Mitzrayim. But there's not really topography described, right? We don't know what Ur Kasdim looked like. Eretz Canaan is specifically described as Haaretz Asher Areka, right? The land that I will show you. He leaves to go down to Mitzrayim because there's a famine. but Mitzrayim isn't described as a place. Sodom is described before it's destroyed as lush, right? There's no desert, which is really interesting, right? Because there's a lot of desert in this part of the world. So the first time we hear of desert, qua desert, is with Yishmael. And in both of the Yishmael stories, both in Perek Tetvav, in chapter 16, and then again in chapter 21, which we'll get to in a second, the Yishmael, Hagar, Yishmael, and the Midbar are linked to each other, right? So we pick up in Perek Tetzayin in chapter 16, where Hagar has run away, and she's run away from home, basically, from Sarai's cruelty, and she's plunks herself down, and a malach finds her. And look at where the malach finds her. It's actually, again, we know this story so well that we don't think about the juxtaposition. The malach finds her al ein hamayim b'midbar. Finds her by a well in the desert. So what's fascinating, again, about the desert in Tanakh is that there is water. And the water here, and I'm leaving the simple meaning of the text and going into a much more homiletic, midrashic, symbolic meaning, right? What happens? A malach finds her by a spring of water. Now, a malach isn't going to talk to Hagar or is going to talk to anybody unless they are spiritually open enough to hear that malach, right? So there is, first of all, there's literal life within her. She's pregnant, but there is spiritual life in her. She, as the wife of Avram, as the mother of Avram's future child, as the woman who has lived in Avram's house for 10 years, has absorbed a lot of this holiness. And she is spoken to by a malach, by a well in the desert, right? And again, el ha'ayin b'derech shur. So this is a particular well. This was a known well, and it's on the way to shur. And he says to Hagar, right? He says, "Where emi zebat the ana telchi?" And again, this question can be read both literally but also figuratively. It's like, what's going on? You know, why are you in the middle of this wilderness, but also by a well? Now, again, on a simple level, the answer is obvious, right? If she's by a well, that means there's water. That means she's not going to die imminently. But on a deeper level, right? It's like, you're living two lives right now. Why are you trying to live two lives? Why are you trying to be a desert dweller, but also a spiritual being? And she answers him. She said, because Sarai givirti ani baracha, because I'm running away from Sarai. I'm running away from my mistress. And then Hashem says to her, right? Says to her, go back and you're going to have a child. And yeah, I skipped a bunch of psukim. And then he tells her, the malach tells her about Yishmael, v'hu yiyya pera adam. He will be a wild man. Yado bakol v'yad kolbo. His hand will be in everything or in everyone, and the hand of everyone will be in him. V'al kol p'nei achav yishkon, and he will dominate. Right? So this child that's going to be born to her, Yishmael, which is a beautiful name, and let's not forget that we have at least two Tanaim with that name. Right? We always think of Yishmael as this evil brute, but he's really not. We don't have any Tanaim with the name of Esav. So he is going to be this kind of a person. He's going to be wild, and he's going to be strong, and he's going to be a ruler, and he's going to be involved. And later on, right, I'm moving to the second Yishmael narrative, right, where again they find themselves in the desert. Right, this is the moment where Hashem has told Avram, listen to Sarah, tell him, you know, kick them out, basically. Right, so what does he do? He gives them water and food, and he takes them, and he sends them, she and the boy, So he sends them away, and again, she goes to the Midbar. And she goes to the Midbar that's near Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is where they were living at the time. And again, they're in the desert, but this time the water runs out, right? This time there's no well. And again, lit on a very literal level, and Ein Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuto, the water ran out because there was no well. But the water running out, again, is like a symbol of the spirituality running out, the hope running out, the influence of Avraham running out, at least with Hagar. And she is in the desert, and she is so devastated as what's going on that she tosses this teenager under a bush because, well, I can't watch him die. Right? So think of what it must mean for a mother to walk away from a dying child. Like it's horrible. So on the one hand, you can understand she doesn't want to watch her child die. On the other hand, how could a mother abandon her child? But this is how dried out, so to speak, Hagar was at this point. This is how much she had become like that Midbar, and a Midbar specifically without a well. But we know the end of the story. There was a well, right? The Malach comes to her and says, you know, don't cry. Hashem sees Yishmael ba'asher husham, right? The Midbar is not a place of death. The Midbar, again, becomes a place of judgment. It becomes a place of justice. It is a harsh and powerful reality. But at the end of the day, this child was innocent. And Hashem said, he's not going to die, because I am going to judge him as he is there. Right? So, Vayhi Elokim etana'ar, and Hashem will be with this child. Vayigdal vayashev b'midbar, vayhi rava kashat. And what's going to happen to this child? This child is going to grow up, and he will be a wilderness dweller. He will thrive in this harsh landscape. He will thrive because he will be a para adam. He will be a wild man, not in the sense of like a party animal, but in the sense of somebody who can survive in the wilderness, can survive by his bow and arrow, and can survive in this incredible harsh climate. And you know, if you think about where Yishmael lived, whether it was Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Egypt, you know, depending on which Masorah you go by, these are very, very harsh climates. And it takes a certain personality to survive in that kind of a climate. And we might think of hunters, right, of archers as very negative, because we have been trained to be very leery of, at the very best, hunting. Hunting is not a Jewish thing. As a matter of fact, we're not hunters. On the other hand, David HaMelech was also a very, very well-trained archer, as was Yonatan. Right? That's how they communicated with each other. Bow and arrow was a way of survival. So the desert here represents for us, right? Vayashev Bamidbar Paran. And look at where he lived, Midbar Paran. That's a name that comes back to us in our journeys in the wilderness. Batikachlo Imo, then he got married, and then he from Egypt, and then he had children. So here he was in this desert, and he was surviving in the desert. Oh my goodness gracious. I just realized what time it is. So I'm going to continue for a couple more minutes, right? I mean, story of Moshe goes into the desert because it's a place of ownerlessness. And again, as the Midrash tells us, he didn't want his sheep eating from anybody else's land. It's a place of justice, and it becomes a place of revelation. And this Har Chorev, right? And by the way, the word Chorev actually means heat. It's a word that's found in Sefer Yeshayahu, and it happened to have appeared in Daf Yomi, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, very conveniently. Never really knew what Chorev meant, but Chorev actually means heat. it possibly, I'm hypothesizing that it's related to Cherev, right? Kind of that really harsh heat. And again, Har Sinai, this is the wedding. This is the desert revelation. So the desert becomes this harsh, punishing environment, but the desert also becomes the place where you and your lover, you know, in this, or your spouse, can be alone. So I want to just quickly mention a couple of other sources, and that's the story of Eliyahu, right, who also finds himself in the desert, because he's running away and he thinks he's failed. And what happens is that he also encounters a malach. He also goes for 40 days and 40 nights, and he ends up again at Har Sinai. Right? He ends up in the middle of the desert in this mountain of revelation. But in stark contrast to Matan Torah, which is literally fire and thunder and ground shaking, like that whole sound and light Omnimax experience, what Eliyahu experiences in this midbar is the kol demama dakah, right? Is that quiet voice. And that terrifies him. Because the silence and the stillness and that having to be honest with yourself, there literally is nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. That's a really terrifying moment. But the midbar affords you that moment. And if you can kind of plow through that moment, kind of like the way COVID was here, right? Everything, I know that in Israel it was a little different than it was in America, but everything shut down. And you had to be with yourself or with your family. And it was hard. It was hard to be in that silence. But you could learn from it. You could hear God's voice in that silence. I want to leave you with a fascinating bit here from Sefer Hosea. I have to find the beginning of it. Now, this is still Malachim. So Sefer Hosea is a really weird kind of a story, because at the beginning of Sefer Hosea, God says, take a prostitute, marry her, and have a bunch of kids with her. And obviously the prostitute is B'nai Yisrael. But what's fascinating, and I want to share with you and leave you with the opinion here of the Malbim, which I didn't bring down, but you can find it on Safaria, right? In Perek Bet, Hashem kind of changes his mind, and he says, you know what, I love B'nai Yisrael anyway. And he says to B'nai Yisrael, take up an argument, right? Rebuke your mother. We, the younger generation, are supposed to rebuke our elders and tell her she's bad, right? She, kihi lo ishti ve'anochi lo isha. We're not married. Right? But if she gets rid of her harlotry, of her beads and her baubles and all of the, you know, these things that her johns, for lack of a better word, have given her, then I'll take her back. Right? And then he says as follows, because if she doesn't, right, what am I going to do? Else will I strip her naked and leave her as on the day she was born, and I will make her like a wilderness, render her like a desert land, and let her die of thirst. Right? Very, very harsh metaphor. But what the Malbim explains is as follows. What Hashem is saying is that there's a redemption here. Why am I doing this? Why am I stripping her naked? Why am I leaving her exposed to the elements? Because that way there'll be nowhere to run. There'll be nowhere to hide. She will have to confront herself. She will have to confront me. And I want that, is what Hashem is saying. I'm going to take her to a place back to, again, where we all started, where this romance started. And she's going to have to look me in the face, and she's going to have to look herself in the face, and she's going to have to say, you're what I have, right? I don't have another spouse. I don't have another protector. So what do I have to do to make this right again? And there's always that chance. And that's, I guess, where I want to leave you, is that in the desert, we're standing on a precipice, right? Between Chaim and Mavet, Ubacharta B'Chaim. Right? Bruce Feiler, at the end of his series, Walking the Bible, said the following, right? The word Midbar has the Shoresh Daber, which also is ironic, right? How does speech come from a place of silence? But that's exactly the point. It's only when you are in a place of true silence, of the absence of distraction, and in a place of vulnerability and really stripped bare, that you can begin to hear your inner voice that is your neshama, and your inner voice that is your neshama, which is the bridge between you and me and all of us and the divine. So I leave you with that thought, and I hope that the rest of your 9 days and your Tisha B'Av is meaningful. And my bracha to all of us is that may this be the last Tisha B'Av that we spend in collective Avelut. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Are there any questions? I know I went long. I'm really sorry.
Don't worry.
It was worth it.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay then. I mean, can Emma, can people unmute themselves and ask questions?
Yeah, people can unmute.
Okay.
But yeah, thank you so much for speaking. We really, really appreciate it. And
pleasure.
For everyone who is here in Chicago, we look forward to seeing you tonight if you register to come in person for the final section of our Yarach Leikala, which is the final keynote with Rabbi Brand tonight. Have a good rest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.